Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. This episode, we're going to be moving into World War I and World War II and setting it up to go into after the war up to current day. So look for two more episodes coming after this one. It'll end up being a six-part series with Wayne Jett on all the economic turmoil before, up to, and through the Great Depression and up to current time. And I recommend, if you really like this information and want to learn more and more detail, purchase his book, Fruits of Graft. You can get it at his website at classiccapital.com. And also, if you enjoyed these series, consider supporting my program on patreon.com. I'm under Sarah Westall. I'd like to keep doing more series like this, bring the truth of history and things that are going on in the world. Also, I cover edges disruption, things that are changing in this world, bringing to people what they probably don't see on an everyday. I'm bringing you the top leaders in the world that are making change so you see what's going to be happening as the world goes forward and what we're up against, and also bringing you truth on big issues. So I hope you enjoy this, and we'll get into our fourth episode now with Wayne Jett.
Now, on that basis, I would like to move on promptly to the war. Instead of covering the Keynes Mutiny right at this point, let's talk about the wars, World War I and World War II.
Okay, let's talk about that, because when we got into World War II, that pretty much pulled us out of the Great Depression, right? Or no?
I will disagree strongly with that, and I think I said so briefly in our previous talk. But it did not. That is one of the, I would say it qualifies as a big lie, because it is still used even to this day by the Keynesians as saying one of the teachings that Keynes had in his big work is that war is one of the things that restores economic growth. A very, very dangerous and big lie. Even today, is in the past year, I've seen it talked about in public discussions that if we could just have a war, things would be a lot better for various parts of the world, including the U.S. The opposite by far is the case. In fact, just in the last week or so, I saw an interview by a current person who comments on such matters as this, who referred to the Civil War. He was describing the Civil War. This is Dr. Steve Pachinik, a former very top operative for the CIA, for the State Department, the man who's credited as having been responsible for the last months and years of bringing down the Soviet Union to the point of actual collapse. He was describing the Civil War, and he said that he regarded the Civil War of the United States in the same vein that he sees the slaughter of Cambodians by Pol Pot, the deliberate slaying of humans just to get them out of the way and not have to deal with them anymore. I was taken by that comment about our Civil War, and he went back to explain, as I had certainly noted previously, that our Civil War was conducted in such a fashion, finally, by the generals, particularly the North, that it sacrificed tremendous numbers of lives in battles that just threw bodies against each other until they killed each other. Let's look at what he called that a specific term. He called it autogenocide, that he viewed the Civil War as autogenocide, the same as Pol Pot. Now, in that little background, let's look at what happened in World War I, the so-called war, the Great War, to end all wars. In 1916, this is before the U.S. even became active in the combat in 1917. In 1916, Great Britain lost 420,000 lives in a single battle on the Somme River in France. And I've read previously that military authorities evaluate that and say that it was not even a battle that Britain needed to fight. They were not required to do it. Yet they spent 420,000 lives of young men to fight it. Gained nothing. Germany, in the same battle, lost 450,000 men. France lost 190,000. So that is more than a million. Now that was at the Somme River, and the next battle, or one of the other battles, also in 1916, was Verdun. France lost 350,000 men in that one. Germany lost 300,000. Russia lost 1 million lives during the summer of 1916 in an inconsequential battle in Galicia. 1 million, a single battle. During 1916 alone, in only those three battles, the Somme River, Verdun, and Galicia, over 2 million men dead. That is hard to imagine for any purpose other than genocide. These were all young men capable of reproducing, of having families and leading families and so forth. Now, I've told you in that vein that what Norman Dodd's investigator had found, and that this was the kind of thing that the Carnegie Foundation had already concluded was the principal means by which to mold people and societies and governments in the way you want them controlled. And I believe that I'm convinced that World War I was entirely in that vein. There are many other battles. The entire loss of life by Russia alone in World War I, I believe, was 20 million. I don't say that with a great deal of confidence. I don't believe that included World War II, but I would have to go back and make sure whether it included the losses of World War II. But both of those wars were fought in great part on Russian territory, with the German army deep in Russian territory. And that is, of course, after the wars that Russia had from invasions by Napoleon. So you can see why Russia is greatly concerned nowadays about the continued threats of invasion by NATO, with the training exercises running up to border countries, making it appear that that our forces are going to go in there. And they're never sure whether this is a training exercise or whether it's a real invasion this time.
Well, can I ask you, after you've got this book out and many people have started seeing it and reading it, Have you had anybody come back to you and say, no, this is an interpretation, your interpretation is inaccurate?
I have had the silent treatment from anyone in the nature of so-called recognized authorities. That is the treatment I think that a person is given when he's not getting enough attention to give him attention. And therefore, they would rather suppress the information than confront it. So, no, I have not had people confront the book. I could.
It would be nice to have if they disagree with it. If there's any facts that are, it's not. Yeah, come forward and tell me where I'm wrong. What facts am I wrong? Where am I interpreting this wrong? So that we can clear that up.
Well, for example, I've done quite a number of things, but in one instance, you may remember a few years back when Ben Bernanke was still the head of the Federal Reserve, he made several trips to the Georgetown, I think it was Georgetown University campus, yes it was, to give little lectures about what the Fed does to the students there. And he was talking about what the practices were. And I actually wrote to the newspaper who was writing up his visits and challenged them to please ask me to debate Mr. or Dr. Bernanke about what the practices really are, because what he's alleging the practice to be cannot possibly be what is being done to manage the money supply. Because, in fact, the overnight rate is incapable of being the tool of managing money, the money supply. And I would like to lay out my case for that. Please invite me to a debate. I never got a response. That is that ties into another experience that I had that actually was before I wrote the book. That was a situation in which back when the man I was working for, who was such a great economic forecaster, Jude Winiski, at one point I wrote a short couple of paragraphs and sent it to him, making my argument in very brief terms, that the overnight rate for funds that the Fed uses could simply could not be the controlling element for our money supply or the money quantity. The reason I was convinced of that was a very simple explanation. You cannot write, and nobody has, you cannot write a mathematical formula by which that overnight rate is even a factor in controlling the money supply, let alone the controlling factor.
So what does control the money supply?
Well, it is a combination of things relating to the monetary base, which basically is an operation involving the sale of bonds or the purchase of bonds or the sale of bonds. The Fed creates currency. There's a certain amount of currency created by the banks in their leveraged lending, the fractional reserve lending. But basically, what controls the money supply starts with the monetary base. And that is the money that the Fed itself puts out for the purpose of purchasing U.S. Treasury bonds. At least this was the case for a long period of time until after 2008, they actually started buying something different. They started buying mortgage bonds as well. And now they've done more buying, issued more dollars into the monetary base. It's at least 5 to 10 times larger than it was in 2008, based on these new practices that have created much more monetary base. But most of that has been so far kept out of the economy. But it is essentially that issuance of new funds into the monetary base that gives rise to the amount of money in the economy. What the reason they give attention to the overnight rate is because that is a way, surreptitiously, or well, without telling anybody, to fix the rates at which the major banks lend money into the economy. It is a price-fixing thing that the major banks want so they don't have to compete with each other. The Fed sets the overnight rate, and then the major banks set their prime lending rate at, I believe, 3% above the overnight rate. So that means all of them do it the same way. They don't have to compete with each other. And they do that regularly, and they don't get sued for antitrust violations. That's the Fed's purpose in emphasizing that rate. After Mr. Winiski passed away suddenly in August of 2005. I should say that when I sent those couple of paragraphs, he says, "Oh, this is important. We ought to write a piece for the national press to do this." He says, "I'll arrange it. You write the piece, and we'll do it jointly." And I wrote up the draft. He made a couple of editings, and the only place he could get to publish it was the Washington Times, even though he had been editor or associate editor of the opinion section of the Wall Street Journal. No opening there. Things like this don't get published by the big press. Washington Times published it. It really got no particular attention. But after Mr. Winiski passed away, I decided I would write that argument up as a complete analysis suitable for publication in the International Monetary Journal. This was a journal that was actually started, as I recall, at least he was one of the influential persons behind the starting of a journal that publishes international monetary policy for all the central banks and so forth. It's the big academic thing. I wrote a complete analysis on it that, frankly, to this day, I think is as good, maybe better, a piece than has been published in that magazine. I submitted it under their guidelines, and under the guidelines, they said, if you submit a piece and it's not turned down within 2 weeks, then you can regard it as being considered by our review committee, and we will notify you no later than 2 months whether it's accepted. I did that. I didn't hear from them within 2 weeks. I didn't hear from them within 2 months. I had been told of the man who was responsible for reviewing such manuscripts, and he was a well-regarded professor, I think still is, at Stanford University, professor of economics. I contacted him. He was very considerate and said that it was still under review by a panel that he had sent it to, but he hadn't been able to get any responses from them. He said he would undertake again to do that and get back to me as soon as possible. I can't recall how many weeks or months it took him after that, but it was sometime later, a month or two, something like that. that he finally got back and he said, I finally was able to get one review. And he blackballed the article you wrote, and so therefore it can't be published.
How do you blackball? They have the right to just blackball. One person blackballs, then you can't publish something.
That's what I was told, and I asked, well, let me see what he had to say about it. So I was given a little short one-page thing, and I'm not sure it even took up half a page. It was, in all honesty, it was gibberish that made no academic, had no persuasive academic use at all. I had made a few references in the piece to, you know, what was then so popularly called supply-side economics. I was not espousing it as being the basis for this analysis. I just made some references to it. And this, whoever the anonymous blackballer was, I never learned his name, said that, well, there's no reason to consider anything from supply-side economics because Keynesian economics already considers both supply and demand. And so, therefore, there's nothing here to see. I mean, that might have even been, might have done it too much justice. It was just pure nonsense that was unworthy of any kind of academic publication. And so it was a very a bad experience, but one that was not entirely unexpected. I've just seen too many things of that kind in which the influential have their way and they do not want to have to confront and actually meet toe-to-toe arguing these issues. I still have the article. I feel sure I've got it stored someplace and could provide it to you. But
that would be great. I'd like to have that because then I can provide it to the listeners. Do you?
Well, I might say that I actually make those full arguments in my book in one of the chapters to show when I take apart the monetary policy of the Fed and the way it's administered, particularly since 1970. I make the full argument about how the overnight rate can't possibly manage the money supply and is actually used in order to fix prices among the banks.
That's very interesting. Can we get back into, so we can finish this out this episode,
yes.
And then next episodes we can get back into the World War II, finish that
yes.
up, and then next episodes we can take World War II to 2008.
All right. Let's see.
And I'd like you to explain to us why wars, because this is a common thought, wars will help the economy. It'll get us out of our problems. Why does that not happen?
Okay, let me do that in the way of referring back to Keynes and his so-called general theory. In the chapter on the Keynes mutiny, I discuss how the Swedish economist Eli Heckscher, who was the authority on mercantilism, basically said that Keynesian theory is nothing more than pure hypothesis. Its assumptions can neither be proved nor disproved. That was the leading economist in the world on mercantilism at the time. One of the things that Keynes said in the general theory book is that pyramid building, earthquakes, and even wars may serve to increase wealth.
He just had a statement like that, and then from then on, everybody believed it?
He made some slight arguments about it, but they are completely unworthy of any serious mind. For example, let's look at pyramid building. We had pharaohs using slave labor to build pyramids for no purpose apparent to us today, although there may very well have been purposes that we're not publicly aware of. But doing so with slave labor who doesn't get paid, and that's economy building. Why else would we build one? Earthquake. Well, he's talking about public works. Public works, in effect, can provide prosperity and jobs. Well, no, you basically go into debt and spend money. Earthquakes, destruction, and so forth. He says can increase wealth. Well, again, earthquakes destroy capital. They destroy possessions. They destroy wealth. And to say that in order to borrow money again in order to rebuild, that it increases wealth, it's preposterous. Wars are the same way. Wars are the most destructive of the three. Wars, everyone knows, they blow up buildings. They kill people so they can never be prosperous. They kill the workforce. They use the workforce in ways other than, well, primarily to build armaments and weapons. But other than that, there's no wealth created in it. Yes, you have to pay usually workers to build those weapons. But the idea that wars actually create prosperity when they destroy wealth in tremendous proportions, not only spending the what would be today billions that just it costs just to make the weapons that blow up, but the things they blow up, including the people who could be productive, all is completely destructive of wealth creation.
So wealth creation is really created by innovation, new industry, expansion of ideas.
That is correct. And there's so much to support that. I have in my book on Keynes' mutiny a little section I call a quiver of errors, in other words, mistakes, in which I list 10 major errors that practically fall right out of. I mean, they're practically just easily recognized as being errors when you initially see them. They make no sense, and yet this is the man still revered as the leading light of economics in the 20th century, and the one that still guides U.S. Economic policy today. I don't.
And do you believe that's by design to what the Wells Manifesto, it's because it backs that what H.G. Wells, what he wrote in the manifesto versus being sound economics? Do you think they're doing that on purpose, or do you think people just don't understand economics?
I think it most certainly is on purpose. And in the same way I told you last time that Henry George sold more books of the same book, 2 million copies sold, far more than any other economics book in history, and yet nobody knows who he is today. The public never hears of him. I never heard of him until I picked up the book. He was expunged from American consciousness, even though he was the second or third most highly respected person in the country. I think Mark Twain was ahead of him. At the time that Henry George was alive, he died in the late 1890s, and yet expunged from our history. The same way Malthus, the guy that at the end of the 18th century, 1790 or so, wrote about population growth is the our largest danger and risk. Henry George had proved Malthus was completely wrong and people all over the world were convinced by Henry George's book, and yet Thomas Malthus is still famous and is known by everybody and is taught in our history books, in our college courses, our high school courses. I don't know what they teach these days in high school, but Malthus and his idea that population growth is going to destroy the world is still revered when the opposite was shown to be true by Henry George. In the same way, Henry George was expunged from the record, and John Maynard Keynes has been made famous, even though he's completely wrong about everything. Another example of how our media and our academics are controlled.
Well, let's talk about population, because do you believe that we can grow, just keep growing, and still be able to feed ourselves enough meat and not kill, species and things like that? Because we do have a problem where we kill species off and,
Well, there are a number of self-regulating type of truths. For example, that when people become more wealthy, they don't have more children; they have fewer. In terms of the resources of the world, there are great resources that are hoarded and kept precious and expensive. A very good example of that is energy, in which
that is true,
in which oil and gas are still treated as if they are made over millions of years and are running out and so forth. When I think it's clear enough that is not true. They don't come from decaying dinosaurs. They come from a process in the earth that remakes them, replenishes them, and yet.
How often does it get replenished? I'm curious about that.
Well, I'm not prepared to be technical about that at this moment,
but enough where it's a renewable type of.
Yes, it's much more frequently renewable.
But we have other energy sources that are available to us anyways, but keep going.
We have very important energy sources that some people are quite hopeful are going to come to the fore in the very near future. The problem in the past has been that they've been prevented by our government in many respects from being disclosed, because it is much in the interest of those who own oil and gas. Many great fortunes have been built around that in order to keep that precious and also to control more of it by invading other countries. So that is the whole population matter is much better explained than I can do here. In Henry George's book, I would love for the readers to take a look at that. But I think his arguments are as valid today as ever, and I do provide discussion of that as well in my book. It is
that's an important thing to read, especially with how things are going with. Ending aging. We're actually on the cusp of ending aging in the next couple decades. The biggest concern is population issues with that. There's a lot of issues we have that's going to come rushing at us.
For example, matters relating to mobility, I think there are important sources indicating new sources of energy that are not only clean, but they are free from the standpoint of able to extract electromagnetic energy in ways that I don't think we just have time to get into discussion of them.
Well, and I did a show on zero point energy field. So there's a lot that's out there that is pretty incredible. But do you want to finish up on this war issues and then we can get into the other issues in the next shows?
Well, I think that we've said about as much as we need to say about the war.
One thing that you mentioned is you mentioned FDR ignores Hitler's offers. What did Hitler offer FDR that he ignored?
Well, let's see. In my book, I go into the aspect that there was a naval officer commissioned by FDR to be posted in Turkey during the war. Turkey was not a combatant in World War II as it was in World War I. And so Turkey was a listening post, we'll say, for, you can say, spies or intelligence, whatever you wish. But this naval officer, I can't even bring to mind his name at this point, but he was sent to Turkey by Roosevelt as his emissary for the purpose of learning what was going on. While he was there, he was contacted by high-level German sources who said that they were ready to overthrow Hitler and end the war. This basically was speaking on behalf of the general command of the German military. And that information was transmitted by diplomatic pouch back to Washington as quickly as possible by that naval officer. He gave details about it. He could not get a response. He did it, I think, three times, still no response. And essentially, the efforts of the German high command to end the war, I think would have ended it for certain well before D-Day. So it would have been an early end of the war, much less loss of life, certainly for Americans. And in a way that would have done much less damage to the countries there. There was never a response from the White House to this man. He finally came back over, tried to meet. I provide the details. I've not reviewed that in some time, but essentially he was dismissed from office. He was threatened with being sent to the Japanese front, something of the sort. This was a man, the naval officer was, as I recall, a former governor of the state of Pennsylvania, and had been a Roosevelt supporter of the Democratic Party. But that was the kind of offer I think you're referring to that that basically got the back of the hand, no response, so that the war could go on.
Yeah, because they were very...
I think it was even before the invasion of Italy. It may have been after the Italian invasion, but it was before D-Day.
So why were they so committed to want to go to war, in your opinion?
Again, as I've indicated that the research of Mr. Dodd learned, there was a conclusion on the part of the ruling elite that war was a very good way of controlling countries. It certainly was a way also of building their own wealth, because the people who are the ruling elite, they not only lend money to finance armaments, they also build armaments and sell them and so forth. So their fortunes are greatly multiplied by war. And one of the things that they believe most fervently is that the fewer human beings there are, the fewer human beings can challenge their right to control the world.
And it's easier to kill a million people than to control a million people.
Yes. And in fact, I think after World War II, the view has come more to the point that war just isn't good enough at killing people. We have to do more about poisoning them. I mean, in all honesty, I may have said to you last time, but if I didn't, I'll certainly say it again now, that the so-called influenza of 1918, I think has pretty clearly been shown by research on the subject. It was a man-made disease that was spread initially. The first person infected was an assistant cook of a military unit at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, that was immediately dispatched upon as soon as this man was infected. They sent the whole outfit to Spain, and the influenza, so-called, was highly infectious. It spread through that unit. It spread through Spain. It spread into Europe. They brought some of the people back here. It spread to the United States, and that influenza of 1918 killed more people than we've lost in all of our wars put together.
Yeah, that's incredible. So there has been, everybody formally denies that, I'm sure.
Well, I hate to. There are grandparents within my family tree. Grandparents lost at a young age. Both my wife's grandfathers were lost to that influenza when they were vigorous, young men, athletic, strong, and they died within 3 or 4 days of contracting the disease.
Wow.
It was absolutely devastating. My wife's grandfather was age 26, a football player when he was in college at the University of Virginia. A young banker went to visit a friend. This grandfather felt he had never been sick. He wasn't worried about going to see the friend who had this stuff. I think he died within the same week. And it's a strange thing, but I learned that the physical characteristics of people who were given an autopsy from that disease, the description of their physical characteristics of what happened to them inside is very much like an attack of the disease. Oh my gosh, here I've lost the name of it.
Ebola,
Anthrax.
anthrax.
Anthrax. The one that was prohibited, I believe, by international law from, or at least agreed by treaty, that nobody would ever do that. It basically burns the lungs to black. And it's funny that
So it wasn't influenza, it was probably something else.
something else. It was there's a book by the name of Vaccine B that actually is an expose of how the treatments of vaccinations given to U.S. soldiers going to the Gulf War in the 1990s was actually, we'll say, adulterated vaccine that was intended to be ineffective in making them immune to anthrax. And in that book, There is a discussion of the history of the influenza of 1918 makes me gave me that idea. It also describes an anthrax victim that died in eastern Russia, and when the news of that became known in the intelligence communities that a person died of anthrax in Western Russia, that's around the intelligence community of the Soviet Union at the time, and the U.S. intelligence became greatly alarmed that they must be doing experiments with anthrax, or that person wouldn't have died of anthrax, and that's where this vaccine started working on. A vaccine for anthrax, and that book tells the story of all of that. It's a very sordid thing in which even our military knew it was vaccinating people in ways that were harmful to them, not helpful, and did not protect them from anthrax.
That's just okay. So let's wrap up today's episode and get it ready for next time. I'm hoping next time we can talk about the after Roosevelt, the two-party domination and how that all developed. I wanted to talk about Nixon and the gold standard and what all came about there. And I also wanted to talk about the middle class values on Wall Street and why the middle class has been purposely carved out. And why they're trying to keep the middle class at bay. And then moving on to the tech crash of 2000, how the big investment houses like Goldman Sachs profited from it, and then also the financial terrorism of 2008, and how this is kind of the big one, how $13 trillion of private capital was pulled from the US economy, and then what ultimately happened with that. And then we can wrap up, but I'm assuming that will be a good three or four more episodes.
Well, that sounds like a real plan to me. I'm happy to proceed on that basis. And I certainly thank you for your time today. I hope we were able to cover some things that are worthwhile.
Well,
It's a far.
in closing, can you wrap up your final thoughts on the Depression and the wars?
Well, there is a. The last part of chapter six. I include a section called Humanity at Mercantilism's Table. And I don't think I can discuss it, but it basically tells the circumstances of what people were experiencing then. And I wind up with a concluding paragraph, which actually gave me the title of my book. And maybe
You
I can read it.
or I could
It,
read it for you too as
yeah,
we exit the
yeah.
show.
Well, yes, that would be wonderful. It's the end of chapter six, the last paragraph. And it says, well, American mercantilists had no difficulty seeing through the folderol of Roosevelt's social program window dressing and setting it aside. They, the American mercantilists, I mean, easily recognized their own agenda in the president's acts, and the fruits of their graft were bountiful in the extreme. Each could confide unflinchingly to his memoirs what a paradise on earth existed in the 30s when his great fortune was multiplied and he could acquire resources and assets of every kind in the world over for mere pennies on the dollar. End quote. Sorry about that.
That's okay. It's a really hard thing after doing all this research. Well, I think that's a good closing, and I thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah, very much.
Well, that's all we have for today. This is the end of part four of the series with Wayne Jett. I do have two more that we're going to have to bring us to current time. The next episode, we're going to start with questions from our listeners. There's been some really great questions. So we're going to answer those. And then we're going to use the last two episodes to move all the way up to current day. And so that would complete our six episodes with Wayne Jett. However, I asked him to come back and do an additional episode that just focuses on H.G. Wells' Elite Manifesto. So that one will be just an hour long, and we're going to take a dive into that. I think that's very interesting because that really set the stage for a lot of things that happened afterwards. So I hope you tune in for that. So keep an eye out for that one. It'll probably be out a few weeks after part six is released. And part six will be released, the next two episodes, five and six, will be released next week when we have time to get those all engineered and out there and set up for you to listen. So for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.